Hello and welcome back, everybody, to the Ortho Talk podcast, episode number 40, the big 4-0. This week we have Brendan Holderreed on with us. Brendan is a medical student at Texas A&M, and we talk about his journey through the match application cycle for orthopedics this year. Brendan did not match, and we talk about all of that, going through what he went through with the match, his options after not matching, SOAP process, transitional years versus research years, the benefits of both, and it's a good listen. Hope you guys enjoy it. Without further ado, Brendan Holderreed.
Hey, can we time out? All right, all good dudes, stop what you're doing. This is Time Out. This is the Ortho Talk podcast. Today we are doing a real conversation with an illustrious guest. Surgeons today are Asif Khalid and Jay Chen. Antibiotics, ANSEF, of course, what do we even ask? Fire risk, high due to lit conversations and explosive topics. Any questions or concerns? Nope. All right, we can go. Incision.
There we go.
Welcome to the Ortho Talk podcast. We're at episode number 40. All right, that's a lot of episodes. We have a special guest with us this time, Brendan Holderreed. He's a fourth-year medical student out of Texas A&M. So welcome aboard, Brendan.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
All right, we're going to see if you can fill Akil's shoes as the medical student guest that we usually have.
There's some big shoes, man. He looked like a big guy. I don't know. We'll see though.
Yeah. Tell us about your situation. What's going on in your life?
So I applied this past cycle to orthopedic surgery and didn't match, and so that's kind of been my life since not matching. Just trying to find research because I'm doing a research year at Houston Methodist. Moving forward, but that doesn't start until May.
Nice. What were your thoughts? I mean, this was such a tough year for you guys with the virtual, you know, basically everything being virtual, no in-person interviews. What were your thoughts on it? Just going through that this year.
For me, it definitely changed, but it changed for everyone. So just like, you know, sometimes there are conditions that you're going to have to adjust to. I didn't focus on it too much. I just focused on how I could kind of maximize my chances of matching given the situation, because I knew every other applicant was going through the same thing. Because I thought to kind of point to that and say, well, this is out of my control, was kind of just everyone was going to deal with it. So I needed to kind of find a way to work through that. Obviously, that made it hard to build rapport, you know, not being able to do aways and things like that. But again, that was kind of the situation every applicant was in.
What did you think of like virtual aways and stuff? Did you get involved with that kind of stuff?
I thought that, there's just a certain level of commitment when you go in person. And again, like building those relationships interpersonally, I think some of the virtual aways, if you look at the time commitment and things like that, they're just different. And so I think, you know, if you go, I know you guys referenced, like there's like a Google spreadsheet, you go look, somebody's like, I did 8 virtual aways and got 6 interviews. The commitment's just so different that it kind of makes you question if they're equivalent, I guess.
Did that actually happen? 8 virtual ways and 6 interviews?
Those numbers are just, you know, exaggeration, but okay. People working on there. I saw double digits, you know, people.
So like, double digit virtual ways?
Right. Like people are like claiming that. And I mean, anyone can post anything on there. I've learned to take everything with a grain of salt coming from there.
Yeah. I think I've said this before, but basically I just feel that's just so much pressure for you guys, because you guys are still expected to do your home AIs, like 3 of them, you know, 4 of them, in addition cramming time for virtual OAs. And I was at this meeting a couple weeks ago, this AOA meeting, and they talked about doing virtual OAs and having it again this year. I'm just like, can we just like cut this down for the following year? Because the expectation is so ridiculous. And then people at the meeting were like, yeah, one trend that we noticed amongst the students that we advise is that the students who like really put themselves out in virtual ways tend to match better and this and that. And I'm like, man, that's the expectation. That's just, you're asking students to put in like 100+ hours a week if they're into all these virtual ways. So I don't know. It was kind of off-putting to me, but I've done that before.
Did they mention how well you can gauge a student on a virtual way?
There was talk about it. You know, I think they could gauge some things about them, but it's not, you know, they weren't like, this is just as good as an in-person rotation. So,
yeah, I don't get it. I don't get it. Like, if you're doing double-digit virtuals, like, theoretically, you're doing, like, multiple at a time, right?
Right.
So, right. Like, I don't know. How do you, is it, I mean, I guess it depends on what the away is. Like, are you doing a lecture every night? Or are you like, I don't know. What were your aways like? Like, did you have, was it weekly? Was it daily? Like, what was your time commitment for an away?
So for me, A&M has, we talked about the multiple campuses. So I guess we can kind of touch on that. They actually have three ortho residencies associated with them. So those are all home rotations. And as an A&M student, you're able to rotate through those. So that's what I was doing. And, you know, those kind of were my main focus. And I tried to be there as much as possible. So there was like Ortho Access, I think, was the University of Chicago. It was more of like an educational like lecture series. I would watch those, but didn't necessarily always show up to the in-person webinar and things like that. I know some of the virtual ways, it was like pre-recorded lectures that you pretty much just said you watch, or there was some more kind of person-to-person interaction. It really depended on the design that the program chose. And so I think there was a big kind of variation in that time commitment.
Jay, did UTMB do
What's up?
Did UTMB do virtual ways?
No, we didn't. But actually, that leads to like my next question. If you were to design a perfect virtual away, like that would be beneficial to you as an applicant, well, how would you design it? Because we're talking about designing one, and you know, just to see what would actually be helpful to you guys.
I think educationally, being able to attend the lectures and being expected to attend the lectures would be helpful. And then as far as how you can kind of design the away and actually gauge somebody, like maybe a research project or some kind of something where you're expected to put in some work and be a part of a team, you know, maybe with a resident attending and y'all maybe meet once a week, twice a week, three times a week for a couple of hours, go over what your expectations are. And then maybe they have a case that they want you to read up on and you guys can talk about it so that you're getting a little bit of responsibility and you can kind of show that, hey, I can communicate. I can, you know, speak the language, do what's expected of me. Because I think that's maybe what's missing from an in-person to a virtual is kind of that interaction.
It's just being able to give the student some tasks and see how they respond and perform basically, right?
Right.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's a cool concept. I don't know, like you could put a student in like a virtual situation. Like, I don't know if any of the places did this, but like that would be kind of cool if you have like, I don't know, one or two students in like a breakout room or something with an attending and a resident, and you like walk them through a virtual consult or like a virtual patient basically that comes in through the ED with this, like what do you want to order, show them the x-rays, the CT scans, and then like talk about operative plan and like all that kind of stuff. I don't know. That might be kind of cool.
Yeah, that is cool. Maybe I'll steal that idea.
But with that, you don't really get a sense of like work ethic and like, you know, stuff like that. So then if you had like a project that requires some sort of time commitment, like Brendan said, a research project or like a presentation or a case presentation or something, and you work directly with a resident or an attending on it, that might be, you know, something you could tell how hard of a worker a person is.
Mo, did you put yourself in just a room that's entirely green?
Like,
where are you at, bro?
This is my future office.
Bro, it looks like a prison.
Yeah, it's not yet, but it will.
Right. Just wondering. That's why I put up a virtual background, because I don't want y'all to judge where I'm at. I'm in a closet right now, by the way.
No, this is a future office, kind of. I need a desk and a computer, so I'm on a laptop sitting on a bunch of boxes right now.
This is what you have to report to.
This is real professional here.
You get to sit on boxes. This is great. All right, so you found out on Monday that you didn't match. How did that work out?
So I was kind of reviewing some stuff on my computer, and the email ended up coming out a couple of minutes, whatever time it was supposed to come out, it came out a couple of minutes early. So kind of looked at it, and y'all were describing this kind of feeling where you're like not happy and you're not sad, like you don't really know what to feel. I kind of looked at my phone and I was like, man, like that's tough, just because I understand what that means for the next year of my life as far as how it's going to change. But at the same time, I mean, I got six interviews, so I wasn't like, you know, up to 15 interviews, like, all right, like you know, statistically I'm good. I was kind of the whole time going through interview season, like, man, I really wish that I could have come off the wait list at a few places and got a couple more. So I'd mentally prepared, but stuff just started moving very quickly that week after not matching because, you know, you have your family that's interested, you have your friends, you're trying to reach out to people who you'd consider mentors to kind of get some advice. And then also, I wasn't sure about prelim year or research year initially. And so I was going through the SOAP process, and that starts an hour after you find out you don't match.
So Akil said that the SOAP was like a disaster this year. Like he said, it was terrible. What happened?
The server could not handle like the traffic for the, you go on the ERAS website and it kind of opens up, like you can apply to unfilled programs. I had decided what programs to apply to fairly quickly by just using like a like control F for the programs that were available, kind of reading the reviews and just seeing which ones were going to be a reasonable option to apply to. But it took me about 2.5 or 3 hours to apply to them because every time you clicked and every time it had to load, it took about 1 to 2 minutes. So that was more of an inconvenience than anything.
That's crazy.
There must have been a lot of unmatched people this year, just like flooding the traffic through the website.
I'm not speaking, you know, I did not match in previous years, but I think maybe most years it's kind of a disaster just going through it. I was like, I can't imagine that this is much better any other year.
Were there a lot of ortho programs unmatched this year? That was one thing we thought might happen with the virtual stuff, is that a lot of places would go unfilled.
There was two, and actually one of them didn't participate in the match. So in reality, there was really one program with one unfilled spot.
My gosh.
Country, yeah.
Yeah, that seems more typical, like for a normal year. So you applied, and like, did you call or have someone try to make phone calls for you or like anything like that?
Yeah, I did. Reached out to a few people, and they, you know, they said they would do what they could. And you're not supposed to hear back until the next day, Tuesday, and then it kind of opens up, and your interviews are just phone calls. Like I got a couple for prelim years, and it's just like a 10-minute phone call, and it's really just a conversation.
Yeah.
And I felt like the people who, in those 10 minutes, we kind of just randomly clicked. Then the following day, there's like an offer. Like there's offer round number one, I think they call it, at a specific time. And so you get an offer and you can accept or decline it. If you decline it, then it's gone. Like they can't offer you again. And so putting that together with the research here, I was kind of like, man, these timelines are different. And so that's one thing I didn't realize is that the research year timeline is totally separate from that SOAP process, which is moving quickly. And so you kind of, for me not knowing which one I was going to go to, was pretty stressful. But
basically sounds like, you know, you apply, you get your offer, and you have to make your decision without even really looking into, you know, pros, cons, you know, benefits and, you know, alternatives. You basically just have to make it on the spot. So what did you, how did you handle, you know, you're doing a research year, so obviously you thought that would be better for you, or how'd you make that decision?
So that was through conversations with mentors. I kind of told them what I was thinking, and I said, I see the benefits of both. And, you know, initially I thought I was going to do a prelim year, and one mentor specifically just kind of talked to me about my application specifically and just said, you know, if you focus on research and have a productive year, you can get where you want to be from that. And they were saying that they thought that would be a better route as far as success of matching next year.
Gotcha. Man, could you imagine being that one orthopedic program that didn't fill their spot, but then they have like hundreds of applicants for that spot, it sounds like. And man, that's gotta be, and then they have to read through all those in like a day or so and just choose someone.
I feel like those places already kind of have a semblance of who they're going to take in case, you know, like, I feel like that stuff moves really quick behind the scenes. And like,
yeah,
you know, they kind of already have an idea of like, hey, this guy went unmatched and, you know, he's, I don't know. I feel like it's
just imagine how many phone calls they'd get from like students, mentors, trying to put in a word for them. Like their phone's got to be going off all day.
Yeah. Well, I had someone ask me to make a call for them. I couldn't get through like to the person. I just really? Yeah, I couldn't get in. I couldn't get in touch. So I shot an email off and tried, but you know, it's tough. I'm sure they get flooded. So there were, wait, you mentioned one thing. There was a program that didn't participate in the match.
Yeah, I don't know the logistics for that program, but I do know that they they weren't interviewing people. I think it was an accreditation thing that they just kind of arrived late in the game. And so they were like, all right, we'll just wait. And then, but all four potential spots were gone in that first offer round.
Wow. So they basically filled a class based off unmatched applicants.
Yep.
Huh. That's interesting. I wonder how that's going to go.
Yeah, they didn't have a Stephanie coordinator like we have at UTMB. That's for sure. All right. Wow, this is really interesting. So your research year, so describe what you're going to be doing this year.
So the way that I've kind of framed it in my mind is I do have responsibilities as an employee for the research projects that are ongoing that are prospective as far as collecting samples for the different studies and consenting patients for different trials. And then there's also kind of the trying to be productive on my own part as far as finding research on my own or finding papers and getting those published. And then specifically part of why I chose the research year that I chose was if I can find some free time, I am able to participate, you know, in scrub cases and things like that. And I thought that was kind of a unique aspect of this one that would let me kind of network at this program specifically and build relationships.
Did you feel like research was a deficiency in your application the first time?
I feel like overall with my application, like 10,000 foot view, the issue was that everything was like good, but nothing was going to make me stand out. Mm-hmm. Like I had research and I had a couple of publications, but it wasn't, I mean, it was probably below average. So it was an issue, which is why I chose to focus on it.
I wonder how big of a role did interview hoarding play this year, where like the people with really awesome applications, you know, with really good step scores and great letters, and they're able to go on more interviews than usual because they're not flying, right? They're not wasting a couple of days flying out somewhere, which costs a lot of money as well. And they're just able to take on more interviews. I wonder if that was a bigger problem this year than usual, where, you know, if your application is ortho average, which is still a pretty good application, instead of getting like 12 interview offers, maybe you only get 6 because literally all the great applicants have applied everywhere and are taking up all the interviews. I wonder if
right. that was all you have to do here. Is like turn on your computer and you can get an interview instead of having to fly.
As a result, like all the people with great numbers on paper, like great paper applicants, probably match better than they typically would. Whereas the people that were average paper applicants might not have matched as well just because of the whole virtual thing. So I don't know, speculation.
I think there's got to be some truth to that, right? I mean, it makes sense, especially if you don't. We've talked about capping the number of interviews and the problems with that, but
yeah,
it makes sense that some people get left behind because there's just less interview slots than there normally would be.
What are y'all's thoughts on capping interviews? Maybe going in the future if that were a possibility.
I just think like, if it's not standard for everyone, it's not going to work. Because if every program doesn't do it, then no one's going to do it, basically. That's my thought. You know what I mean? Go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, you're good. For me, I guess the only thing is if somebody gets capped at 15 and then they don't match, I guess my thought process is if they would have had 25 and let's just say one of those next 10 would get them a match, I can see like, you know, the flip of the argument is kind of, well, you earned those. So it's kind of just up to the individual to turn down the ones that they know they're not interested in.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have very many, but at the same time, my friends that got a lot, I wasn't like, oh, I hope they drop these so that maybe, you know, other people are dropping them and I pick them up. It's kind of just like, that's kind of what they say when they say you're applying to a competitive specialty. So I see both sides of the argument. I guess I don't have a strong opinion one way or the other.
Yeah, that's a good point. Fair enough. Yeah.
I think you can't leave it up to the individual applicant's honor system to cap their own interviews. You know what I mean? I guess that's the point I'm trying to make is you have to keep a firm cap for everyone, but I don't know how you enforce that either. You know?
Yeah. No. Yeah. I agree. No, I agree with that. I mean, when I see stuff on Twitter about like, you know, like, oh, applicants need to police themselves, and I'm like,
that's you're not going to do that. Like, no, nobody's going to do that.
Are you going to, if you have enough interviews to match that 98% rate or 95% rate, and then you stop there, but you're, you know, that 5% happens to you, you're really going to kick yourself in the foot or in the butt or whatever for not taking those 5 extra interviews. And when I advise students, you know, they ask me how many places to apply to, you know, I tell them for the good of everyone, you know, everyone should kind of police themselves. But if you're going to ask me to mentor you and to tell you what's in your best interest, it's just to apply to as many as you can. And to take as many offers as you can. So,
yeah, you know. I mean, especially for a competitive special, you have to make yourself the most competitive. Yeah. Now, there, I mean, the other side of it is like, and I don't think we know the numbers on this, but how many people, like, if you increase your total interviews from 15 to 20, what's the increase in your percentage of matching? And again, I think it's very slim. Once you get past like, you know, a certain number, I think it's kind of like an exponential curve where you kind of hit the top of that curve and you're really talking about like decimal places here. Because I mean, honestly, like, I don't know. I was like you, Brent. I had 6 interviews. Like, I did not take a lot of interviews. I did not get offered a lot of interviews, but honestly, if you can't match with 15 interviews, are you going to match with 20 interviews? Sometimes yes, but I think probably a lot of the times the answer is no. And that's because there's either a big flaw in your application or a big flaw in your personality or your interviewing skills or something like that, that, you know, if the first 15 didn't take you, the last 5 probably won't either. But again, that's, you know, it's generalization. It's not every case, but I think there's a good number of cases like that.
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah, so Brandon, so you're going to try to scrub in more this year in your free time, you said, and try to meet people. Those are all good. Those are all good things. What else do you think this year? You know, are you going to try to take steps to improve interviewing skills? Or are you going to, you know, try to do other stuff as well? Do you have any other plans?
Yeah, I think for me, last year, my interview answers, I worked really hard on them, but they were kind of just my individual answers that I thought of. And I was like, yeah, this is what I want to say. And so I left an interview and I was like, all right, I said what I wanted to say. Like, I'm not going to look back and stress about that. Yeah. I think this year I'll definitely be more proactive, seeking like a mentor's kind of perspective on, hey, this was my answer last year. Like, I really liked this answer, but from your point of view, is there something that I'm saying in this answer that kind of maybe conveys something unintentionally?
Yeah, you'd be surprised how like different people can nitpick things that you think would be totally harmless in an answer, and just like, and even like different interviewers will take it different ways. And I don't know, it's hard to be, that's a hard thing to be good on, because it just depends on who's interviewing you and what they think. But yeah, I've heard of people basically doing that, getting help with their interview process, hiring like an interview coach, or like running answers by people. Mikey from last week's episode basically said like he had to identify, you know, what he was weak on and just like really, really focus on it. So yeah, I think that's a good idea too.
Yeah. Is there are there virtual ways for people that haven't matched? Like, is there an opportunity to kind of show yourself in other programs this year?
So that's a part of doing a research year. One of the advantages is if you delay graduation until December, you can maintain student status in the fall. And so again, another advantage of this research year is I know this person was supportive of me doing an in-person away. So I applied for an away on VSAS, and I'll be able to do that if I get accepted. Oh, sweet.
That's cool.
That is.
Yeah, that's awesome. Which, sure. Yeah, I guess you're not sure which program, but that's cool. Yeah.
So they're limiting how many aways you can do this year too, right? Isn't it like one per person or something?
It is, yeah.
So are they doing virtuals on top of that too?
I think the virtuals, from what I've seen, if it's like an official formal virtual away, it's being offered on the visiting student application service as well. And I think that I didn't look at the wording very specifically, but I think that it is, you can only complete one through VSAS is kind of what they said.
Oh, so it's like, is it one virtual and one in-person, or is it just like one total?
I think it's one total, because I signed something for the place I'm going that said I'm not going to participate in any other away electives at any other institutions.
That's weird.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought you could do like as many virtuals as you wanted, but I don't know.
I'll have to go back and look at that. That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
And ideally, you could do your in-person away and then spend time, you know, at your research place, and then also do a bunch of virtual aways too.
That'd be ideal.
Especially if you're doing a research year where theoretically you could have more time to do the virtual ways than
in the evenings. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. That's a good question. It's kind of, I wonder why they limited, I know why they limited it. I guess it's coronavirus, right?
Yeah.
For the in-person stuff.
Man, I wish they would just go back to full on. Well, that's, you know, like students are all vaccinated now, and most people, you know, most orthopedic surgeons are vaccinated. So I don't know. I kind of miss the old days where you could actually go and audition, you know.
What is UTMB doing?
We've, as far as I know, and this isn't official because I was looking through my emails yesterday to try to find the email I thought I saw, but it sounded like we were not accepting visitors. So, but that's not, you know, that's not official from my mouth, because I was trying to find the email I read. I wasn't able to find
allegedly.
It.
Allegedly. So. This is all alleged.
Allegedly. So, but I mean, it's cool to have people from other places. I think you learn about other programs, and it's just nice to have people visit, and you show the best side of yourself to them, and they show the best side of yourself to you, and it's just a cool thing. But
well, I think the other thing is that the in-person ways help basically spread the word about a program too, because applicants will talk amongst each other, and they'll tell, you know, the people underneath them, like, hey, this was a great interview, this is a great place, you should great away, you should try to go there. It helps the programs out too. So
for sure. We're trying to build up our program, and it's hard to get word of mouth up there. So, you know.
Yeah. So Brandon, did you ever have any thought about like just switching specialties? Or just taking like another position somewhere and moving on?
So I actually explored that kind of prior to fourth year, because I kind of asked myself the question, do I, if I commit to this right now, like I need to make sure that I'm all in, because I understood kind of what fourth year was going to entail, and then residency. And so I kind of thought about it, and I thought about other specialties. I was like, maybe I could do radiology. And I was just like, nothing about it excites me. And so that was kind of what I got left with. And I was like, all right, I'm like 100% sure, because I did step back and ask myself the question, like, am I positive I want to do this? Because for me, I didn't know I wanted to do ortho until I rotated like midway through third year. And just basically a weekend, I was like, all right, this is it. And so once I got to that juncture, like studying for step two, I was kind of like, okay, you've been all in on this because you were really excited by it, but are you going to be able to go through the residency and things like that? And so when I didn't match, I was just like, all right, I just have to figure out how to get back there.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, I don't know what's like to not match. It's got to be very, difficult. But in the end, if you're able to match the following year, you know, you kind of burn a year. But at the same time, it's not the worst thing in the world, because, I voluntarily took a year off after third year med school to get a master's of public health, just because I was like, you know what, I'd like just to have some time off just to, before I get back into the grind of things. And I really enjoyed that year. And I had a girl, like a daughter during that year. So it was a good year. So, I think all things considered, hopefully this works out well, and you were able just to, the year off can be viewed as a good thing sometimes,
I've never met anyone who's matched after reapplying that regretted reapplying, obviously, right? I mean, if you match, it makes it all worth it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So I don't know.
Is your research here, is it paid? Is it a paid position or is it a non-paid?
It is paid. I'm going to start not being paid, just because once that position is available for me to start doing the work, that's in my best interest as an applicant. The hospital is being very slow with the paperwork. So initially it will be unpaid, but that's not because of the nature of the position.
Yeah. What do you also, I saw this post on Twitter, and it basically said something about like, we need to stop, we as, attending physicians or whatever, we need to stop offering unpaid research positions to students who don't match or blah, blah, blah. It was really against it. What do y'all have any thoughts on that? It's like exploitation or something they're saying.
Well, I think it's only exploitation if you infer that you're going to give them something that you don't end up giving them, right? Like we know people who have done basically research years or research internships or whatever you want to call it with, and then not being given an interview when they applied, right? And after being told that they would be given, I mean, that's just being slimy, you know? I don't know. It's just like doing an internship kind of, right? Like is it really exploitation? I don't know. I don't think it is.
I kind of got faced with the situation because there was another research year at somewhere that would be considered, you know, like a really big name, and the is in a different, you know, different state, different city. And the pay was just, it was not enough to live off of. And so I really wanted to go there because I was like, all right, this is like that, you know, opportunity that people will be like, you can't turn this down. But I thought about it and I was just like, I mean, I can't make that money work. And I think if you go into that situation, you kind of have to evaluate financially, evaluate like what your expectations are going to be and who it is that you're going to be working with and if they're going to be invested in you. And I think that's, you know, to go into it and then just kind of claim that you didn't know what you're getting into would be, you know, maybe you need to do some self-reflection, like kind of how you're saying, if they tell you, okay, you're going to get an interview here and people have a good chance and you don't get an interview and you did truly do a good job, well, that, you know, that is messed up.
Yeah.
But for me, I, you know, ended up not doing that because I was like, I see too many things that I can't make work in this situation.
Yeah, I think the term exploitation infers that you don't have another choice, right? And you do have a choice. You can always go do a transitional year or go do you know, something else if that's your main goal is to make money. But, or, you know, I don't know. I don't think it's really exploitation. I think it's more of a give and take between the two parties, right? It's more of a business agreement or a transaction between two parties than a, like, hey, come work here because you don't have any other choice and we're not going to pay you and we're going to make you do all this stuff and then not give you an interview and not match you. I mean, that's pretty rare from what I understand.
Yeah, I was thinking about it, and an analogy came up in my mind where is it like college basketball, where, like, you know, they don't pay the athletes, but then I know it's not an apples to apples comparison, but I was thinking, like, you know, it's not. I agree with you guys. As long as the parties are upfront, like, as physicians, we don't. It's not like we have all the money in the world to shell out $60,000 for a year, you know. So it's not, yeah, that money doesn't just appear out of nowhere. And I think if a doctor is willing to sponsor a student for a year, and the student understands they're not being paid, but if this doctor has the connections that could potentially help them out, you know, I don't know why that should be frowned upon to make that agreement, you know. And it's an example too, Akil, he's our recurring podcast. He didn't go unmatched, but he did take a year off to do an unpaid research year. And for that, if you ask him directly, he'll tell you that probably made a huge difference in his application. So I don't know. I saw that post on Twitter and I was like, is it really that bad as long as people are aware of the agreement and they sign up for it? You know, so.
Yeah, I guess I'm not really understanding the argument why it's exploitation.
Right, right. I didn't
like really. If the two people are agreeing to do it, are you really exploiting someone by not paying them?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, theoretically, they're getting benefit from it too, right? I mean, they're getting, as long as they get the benefit from it, it's not exploitation.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. So,
So the one thing about a research year that you mentioned that a transitional year doesn't give you is that you get to keep your student status. So what, can you explain that? Cause I've always kind of heard it. What's the benefit of that? Of not graduating on time.
So it really, the student status, I think it's about the malpractice insurance that the school can maintain for you, because nobody's going to want you to do an away rotation if you can't provide that. And so I think that's one thing that is big. The other thing is applying to the match as a USMD versus a graduating senior. I think it's just one of those things that they screen people out on. Mm-hmm. And so those are the two advantages that I kind of took away from what I read whenever I was trying to decide.
So I guess if you're applying as a graduating MD, that kind of signals, hey, he didn't apply the first, or he didn't match the first time, I guess. And that's kind of, some people screen that out. Is that the thought?
I think so. I think that the thought is that they have the ability to just like select a filter that says, you know, mm-hmm. we're not going to look at MDs. I don't know. And that's just part of what was recommended to me and what was told to me as far as what one of the advantages would be.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's definitely filters on there. I don't know what filters we used, but I don't know what all the filters are either, because I didn't look through that in detail. But there are for sure filters where you just click boxes and it screens out certain things. So it's interesting. Maybe there is a good theory to that. But I mean, so obviously you're putting yourself out there. You know, coming on this podcast, you know, you're pretty much like, you're making it known that you didn't match, right?
Right. But there,
and I think that's the right way to do it. You know, you go at it heads on. You know, you say, this is what I've done in the interim to improve, and you tackle that in your personal statement. I've heard of people trying to sneak it by, like trying to reapply and not writing their application that they didn't match, and basically just hoping that goes completely unnoticed. And I don't know, seriously, I've heard of this, and like, I don't know how well that works, man. Like,
there's no way. Did you see?
I've heard of this, man. I'm serious.
Really?
Yeah.
How do you hide that, though? How do you hide something like that?
I don't know. I don't know. You just don't disclose it, and you hope that no one sees your, you know, graduation year. I don't really know.
But what if they ask you, like, during your interview, like, oh, this looks a little weird. Did you apply last year? Like, what do you say? Like, oh, that was just a practice run. Like, I was just kidding about that one.
That was my twin. My twin. Just, or something.
Yeah, that was my twin.
Yeah. I don't know, man.
Yeah, definitely don't do that. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, some residents I talked to that are kind of, you know, they read personal statements and things like that. They were like, this is a chance for you to kind of showcase like your maturity and your commitment to orthopedic surgery. You know, this can be a good thing. You just have to kind of own it and, you know, grow from it. And I mean, I played college basketball, but the first school I went to like cut me, even though I was recruited there. I didn't get into med school the first time, which was part of my personal statement last year. So I'm kind of just like, I've been here before, and I'm not a very overly prideful person as far as putting it out there. So people know that, you know, sometimes you just got to get knocked down to kind of get back up and get where you want to be.
Nice. No, that's awesome. That's a great trait. Resilience and Dwayne Wade. And
Dwayne Wade.
Yeah. Remember his commercial from like when we were kids, Mo?
Yeah. Like, it was a fall down like 20 times, get up 21 times or something.
Well, no, it was like 7 and 8, but but yeah, something along those lines. Or was it 8 and 9? Can't remember. But
Do you want to name the school that cut you the first time? So we can trash them on this podcast.
Yeah, let's trash them.
That's fine. I mean, my friends all still played basketball for them. It was McMurray and Abilene.
Yeah.
It was years ago. It's a different coach.
Huh. Yeah, well, McMurray sucks from what I've heard.
I've never even heard of them.
That's how you know they suck.
Yeah.
Where did you end up playing, though?
I played at Texas Lutheran, which is like east of San Antonio and
Seguin. Oh, that's right. Yeah, no, I knew that.
I heard of that school.
Yeah.
I heard of that school.
Oh, yeah, that's a great school. Actually, no, I went to Trinity, which was right
down
there.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. Actually, I remember seeing that now. I forgot about that. Yeah, I went to Trinity. Conference whenever I was there.
Yeah.
Did Trinity have a basketball team, though?
Yeah, but it was D3. TLU was what, D2?
D3.
D3? Yeah. Yeah. So, but there were different conferences. Texas Lutheran wasn't in the same conference when I was there. So it must have been, are they in the same conference now? Do you know?
They were when I was there. I don't know if they switched.
Yeah, it must have been different. But yeah, no, right down the road.
One thing we talked with Akil about in the past about disadvantages of virtual interviews is you can't tell how tall someone is. So how tall are you?
6'2".
There you go. That's perfect. That's my height. That's my ideal height for orthopedic surgeon, by the way. If you're too tall, you
don't. Don't say that. Don't say that. You're gonna get canceled. Don't say that. You're going to dangerous territory here.
I'm only saying that to you, and I can have this opinion. It's free country. If you're, yeah, you're right. I probably shouldn't say that, but
I will say that there is being too tall in orthopedics because you hit your head on things.
That's just what I was saying. Yeah.
So you can't be too tall.
I've seen you hit your head all the time.
I can handle like a light handle every case. It averages like multiple light handles.
Yeah.
I gotta be like just sinking money in this place, but yeah, you can be too tall.
How tall are you, Mo? Disclose it.
you want like my driver's license height or like my basketball height?
Basketball height.
6'6".
What's your driver's license height?
6'4.5".
What's the real height?
6'4.5". You know how like if you're like if they put your height in like the what's that thing, that pamphlet that they give everyone at the games and stuff, or like that's officially listed on the website?
Yeah,
it's like an inch or
program.
Yeah,
program. Yeah,
it was like an inch or two higher than your actual height because you want to like, I don't know, scare the other team and like get them prepared for something that you're not.
Wait, so Brandon, are you really 5'10" then or something?
No. I think I wrote 6'3" on something once, and my coach came back to me and was like, "Put your real height." And I was like,
"Man." My high school coach would have us underestimate our heights, so like we would surprise them at game time. I mean, I thought these were like 5'5", like, you know, midget squad. And then, like,
that's a different way to do it, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah,
it's a weird technique. No, you could definitely be too tall.
Yeah.
You can't be too short, right? That won't get us in trouble. You can't be too short for orthopedics.
No. It's great being short.
Because you can always add step stools. That's the
thing.
You can always add step stools.
But you can't take away legs or knees.
Right.
and honestly, as an attending, I always put the table at the level of the resident. So it actually sucks when I have like from my back.
Don't screw your back over.
I do. Well, whoever's handling the tools, they try to put it at their height. So, you know.
I just jack the table. My PA is like, he's like a 5'10", 5'11" hockey player. So he's like really stout and just like compact. We call him Wreck-It Ralph because he looks like Wreck-It Ralph. But he's got to get like 2 or 3 step stools whenever we're operating, because I just jack the table up because I don't want to hurt my back.
Why don't you sit?
Why don't I sit?
And he can stand. It'll be perfect.
I almost made a joke, but it would have gotten me in trouble, so I didn't. But no, I'm not going to sit. I'm not going to sit. I'm not a hand surgeon.
Yeah.
There you go. I made it anyways. There you go. There's a free one.
Yeah. All right. Cool. So, interesting. So this application cycle, Do you have a strategy in terms of programs you're going to apply to this year? Is it going to be different than last year, or kind of the same?
Probably the same programs. You know, like I did my kind of research on those programs, and I thought they would be good places to go. I think as far as changing the strategy, I'm going to have to kind of be more visible in like that pre-interview invitation period, which to me means just kind of relying on people that I have good relationships with to put in a good word for me, in case those places do just filter by if you're a reapplicant or not. I think, you know, my strategy just like generally moving forward is leave no stone unturned. So if I have a thought in my mind and I'm like, that's a good idea, then just go do it. And I mean, like, that's why I reached out to you guys.
Yeah, like jump on a podcast.
Yeah.
A podcast with a 100% match rate.
We have 100% match rate, and I just don't keep that match rate. So...
No, that's a good idea. Like, I don't know. So when do applications open again? In the fall, right?
Right. I know the due date's September 29th, and I'm not positive when it opens. I think it's the beginning of that month.
Yeah. So I guess the second time around, is you're not going to be as selective with checking those boxes on. That was the other thing I wanted to bring up was, remember there was a talk not just on capping interviews, but also on capping the number of places you can apply to. Remember that? Last year, people were talking about that. I think that's a little more feasible, don't you? If you cap like how many
selections you can make. You can be more selective about if you look great on paper, why would you apply to like, you know, every program, especially some of the ones that you're honestly probably not going to consider, you know, taking interviews at or ending up at if you get great offers elsewhere. I think that makes sense. But
there's no cap on it right now, so.
But it does require self-reflection and knowing, you know, if you think you're a great applicant, but you're really not, The other question is, you don't know what your letters look like, right? So yeah. You have good scores and you're like, yeah, I'll get a ton of interviews. But if your letters are really terrible, you know, or at least average, it probably would have behooved you to apply to more programs, but you don't know that. So
is there a way to see your letters after you apply if you don't match?
Yeah. So, do you think about doing that? Yeah.
I requested them to be able to send them to programs, like for the research year that required them. And so I did see them in that way. I think that, you know, if I would have reached out and said, hey, like, can we review my letter? And maybe what are some things that you've said about people in the past that were better, you know, worse, et cetera. I think they all would have been willing to do that. But as far as like an official kind of way to do it, you know, you waive your right to see it. And if I wasn't using the letter to apply to those research years, I probably wouldn't have said, well, actually, I was going to meet with those people to go over my application and ask about that. So I guess it would come up.
Yeah, because then, you know, that brings up the idea of like people who ask the same people to write the same letters again, you know? So do you have a strategy for that? Are you going to diversify it this time? You're going to have theoretically some more people that know you from your research year too, right? So I guess you could add in that. Like, do you have an idea what you're going to do?
I do. So this year they were all from one program, and I mentioned A&M has three. Like, I've been able to meet people at all three, and I think they know me well enough to write a letter. And so just along the lines of being a reapplicant and feeling like I need different programs to say, hey, this person has what it takes to be an orthopedic surgeon resident or orthopedic surgeon, I'm going to try to get a very strong letter from each of those campuses and then from my away, because that would be four separate places saying, you know, this person is able to do what we're looking for. So
yeah, so diversify it a little bit. I think that's a good plan. So A&M has you said five campuses and three residencies associated with it?
Right.
And there are those three residencies just at different campuses? Are they like linked at all? Do they have the same selection? Like, are they just totally different residencies with totally different programs?
Totally different. So, you know, there's one in Dallas, one in Temple, and one in Houston.
Oh, okay. So, they have one in Houston now too, huh?
That's right.
So I never had that when I was there. When I was there, it was just Temple and College Station for the med school. And there was a program in Temple, which was, I forgot what it was called, Scott and White. I guess Scott and White expanded to Dallas. Right? Isn't like Baylor Scott and White now in Dallas?
Yeah, it's like Baylor University Medical Center is like the residency program with A&M. And then, I mean, Scott & White is, definitely in Dallas.
Yeah, so I guess, is that the program up there now? Is the
right.
Baylor Scott & White program?
It is, yeah. So the Baylor Scott & White, Baylor University Med Center in Dallas, and then Houston Methodist are both fairly new. You know, they graduated classes, and I think Methodist is a little bit older.
So Methodist is part of the A&M system, is that it?
Right.
Oh, is that new?
I don't know how new it is, but it's, you know, not some long-standing partnership, but it's definitely a strong one. They're trying to do like an engineering medicine program they're trying to build up. And so there's definitely something there that's going to be there for a while.
Yeah. So Methodist is really interesting because it's like a research powerhouse. Like, there's so much research stuff going on there. Like everyone had grants, everyone had like their own research teams. When I interviewed there, they were talking advertising like how their residents can basically start their own research departments or like their own research programs to, like, you know, do their own research through the years. It's probably not a bad spot, honestly. You could probably get a lot done there, especially if you got the grants and the funding to do it. So I'm sure that was pretty attractive, like when you did that or when you saw that or heard that.
Yeah,
sorry, I was from guy. I was like, I thought I could make it, but you can't tell how much energy you have left when that bar hits red. But yeah, it's got enough. And then it just died.
That's okay. We were just talking about Methodist. Did you interview at Methodist, Jay?
No, I did not. No. So what was it? Texas, UTMB was the only Texas school I residency program interviewed at, I think, when I went through. I had nine interviews. They're all across the all across the country. It didn't really make geographical sense. Like, I had some in like Pennsylvania, some in like New York and like stuff. I had Washington or sorry, at St. Louis. It was really random for me. Didn't make geographical sense.
Yeah, I think it's like a Texas thing. If you're a Texas applicant, most of your interviews end up being in Texas. Like that's the way mine were.
Yeah.
I had maybe one or two out of state, but not many out of state.
I did have a question. I was going to ask it before my phone died. I don't know if y'all were in some heavy, deep conversation, but
we're talking about Methodist.
I was wondering, like, you know, I think one of the most important sections on the application is your like hobbies and interests, right? And then the idea when you write your application, because it's important because obviously it gives people things to talk about. And then one of the things that I always tell people that are writing their application, I'm like, don't BS on that. Because if you put something and then people ask you about it, you don't know anything at all. And this happens every year where people do this. You know, you'll quickly look like a fake, you know, so if you put your like, you really can play guitar or whatever. And then you're in an in-person interview, and then the guy interviewing you pulls out a guitar and asks you to play something, and then you don't play. You know, that would look really bad. But then I thought, if I were a reapplicant and I had a whole year before I had to interview, I could really pick up some fake hobbies. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'd be like, what are the five most interesting hobbies that I could do? And then I would just like do it for a year straight, and then they'd actually be real hobbies by then. You know. Like I'd be like dirt biking or like skydiving and like what else? I don't know, gardening. It's a really cool hobby that I've picked up lately. But anyway, I don't know if there's any strategy for that, but just a thought if you wanted to pick up something cool, Brendan.
Appreciate the advice. That's a good idea.
Dirt biking, skydiving, and gardening. That was your three.
I mean, gardening is something I picked up a few months ago, so it actually is a really cool hobby.
I don't know what mine would be. Probably like baking. Baking is pretty good.
Baking is a good one.
Shit. You know, that's the one thing like in residency, nobody gets mad at a good baker. Like you could be the worst resident in the world and you bring like a pile of cookies and everyone loves you.
I made that same point last week to somebody.
Yeah.
I made that same point.
I know who you're talking about because they're a good baker.
Well, that's the baker, but yeah, exactly. Yep.
So baking, I probably wouldn't do skydiving because if you,
yeah,
I don't know, that's kind of a dangerous hobby. Like, what if you have an accident during residency and then it's like
program short of resident, which is what they care about. So
yeah,
they don't really care about your well being.
guitar is kind of like bland though. I feel like everyone puts guitar on there.
A lot of people put guitar. This year I had so many people say they're in a band.
Yeah, you don't want to be no guitar, no running. Don't pick up running.
Everyone runs. Everyone plays guitar.
What about everyone's pottery? Pottery would be good.
How would that help the program?
Because you're good with like plaster and stuff.
Oh yeah, okay.
Paper mache.
Yeah.
Crafts. Art activities.
Yeah.
I don't know. What are some other good hobbies you could put on?
I mean, I feel like me, myself and my friends in my class, we all just like go back and forth just being like, you know, we just realize how uninteresting we are right now, like trying to grasp at straws as far as how we're interesting. Like we're just, you know, basically studying all the time and
yeah,
things that we kind of like used to do and used to enjoy doing, we kind of put those to the side to focus on this.
Yeah, we're giving you gold here. We're giving you some gold.
Now's your chance to pick up an interesting hobby in the next year. Oh, MMA.
Jiu-jitsu. If you did jiu-jitsu,
gym.
I had that on mine. Did I tell you that on my residency application?
Was that real
yeah.
or is that?
Yeah, yes. No, I did some kickboxing in my school, so I put kickboxing MMA on my. Application people ask me about it.
Huh, interesting.
So that's a good one. Do a sport that's not like a mainstream sport like that. Or if you put like just the most random sport on there, like cricket or like highlight or like something just totally out of left field that you can talk about, that'd be pretty cool.
I think photography is interesting too.
Photography?
Yeah,
yeah,
because it gives you a chance to share your photos, and then that could parlay itself.
Yeah, but you have to have good photos though, and then you also have to make sure that your like camera roll is scrubbed before the interview So that you don't...
Oh, good point. Good point. Yeah.
That could be dangerous too.
Yeah, good point.
Don't put like influencer. Don't become like an Instagram influencer. That's not going to help anyone.
I don't know.
Podcaster, right? Didn't Akil
podcaster? Put,
podcaster. That's going to start a podcast.
Did Akil say he was asked about that?
Yeah, Akil was asked by someone about the podcast stuff.
Yeah, that's hilarious. I thought it was so funny we put that on there.
Again, 100% match rate, man. It works.
100% match rate.
Yeah, I don't know. Those are
entrepreneur.
Don't put entrepreneur.
What if you really are one?
Yeah, but then it's like, is he gonna scam the whole residency program? Is he gonna be like start a Ponzi scheme? Like, what's going on?
Philanthropist.
That's a good one. Oh yeah, that's a good one.
One watch for Brad's application next year. It was all But yeah, take advantage of the year, pick up some hobbies.
Hey, can we do this new segment that we wanted to try?
Okay.
Brandon, do you know what a good dude is?
No, go on.
A good dude is any person, male, female, in between, who just like lives, breathes, loves orthopedics. It's like, it's hard to explain, but you'll know a good dude when you see them. So like,
Go ahead, Bo.
No, go ahead. I think you were going to add something.
No, it's just someone who like, you know, everyone has ups and downs in residency, you know, it's or as an attending, you know, whatever. And, you know, you're like, oh man, you know, I had this like tough case, you know, I don't feel good about it. And then a good dude response would be like, oh man, every case is a great case. Every case is about learning. Like, I'm sure you learned a lot. Like, you know, it's just like, dude, stop being such a good dude.
Yeah.
You know, so that's...
Well, you'll be like complaining, like, man, I got hit with like 33 consults last night. It's like, oh, that's awesome. Yeah. How many
did you have to do? That's great.
That's great.
I'm so jealous. It's like, dude, shut up, man.
So we wanted to start the segment called the Good Dude of the Week. And we go through Twitter, and you're new to Twitter, so you'll see this a lot, but we'll go through Twitter and we want to pick out like the good dude of the week, who just has like the most good dude tweet that we see that week. And we found one for this week. And I'm okay saying his name. Chris Carver MD is the guy. So Chris Carver, if you're listening at Carver Sports Med, congratulations, you're the good dude of the week. Here's the tweet. Let me know what you think about this. Quote, nothing is more irritating than to fix a fracture anatomically, but the radiologist who reads the final fluoro says alignment is satisfactory. I don't settle for satisfactory. That's the tweet. And then there's a gif. There's a gif of, I guess Samuel L. Jackson giving a stare. So do you settle for satisfactory post-op x-rays? Jay, since you're the one who takes post-op x-rays, Brandon's not trying to get killed and canceled on here.
You know, when you put that, I actually understand completely what he's saying. Like, because I do read my radiology reads on my post-ops, and when they say some crap that's like not true, I actually get really pissed. I was actually going to make a good dude post about it too one day. So like, I don't. They always have this tendency. It always pisses me off when I fix ankle fractures. When I take an X-ray and it's non-weight bearing, the ankle is plantar flexed because it's not weight bearing. It's not at neutral. The patient usually just plantar flexes their ankle. When an ankle is plantar flexed, the medial clear space always appears a little wide. And that's just the way the anatomy is. So what irritates me the most is when I fix an ankle, it's anatomic, I've stressed it intra-op, so I know the deltoid is intact, or I've repaired the freaking deltoid, so I know it's functional and intact. And the freaking radiologist always reads like, you know, fibula in good alignment, there appears to be persistent medial clear space widening. I'm like, and then I want to call him up and be like, bro, y'all don't know what the heck you're talking about, and just like have them. I know people who call up radiologists to have them addend the read to make it like sound better. So actually, you know, that the guy who posted this tweet, but I'm in full agreement with him. So I'm good doing it this week, because that irritates the crap out of me as well.
So I think what you brought up is different from what this tweet brings up. If someone is saying that there's persistent this or that, to me that's like a medical legal issue.
Yeah,
like come on, like radiologists, help us out. Like just, you know, anatomic, much improved or something good.
Yeah, say something good. But even if they say satisfactory.
Satisfactory is still satisfactory though, right?
Yeah, well, satisfactory, that term's never bugged me, I guess. But I do prefer them to say like perfect or anatomic, you know, so.
Yeah.
But I feel you though, that is kind of a good dude tweet.
It's a bit of a good dude tweet. You're on the side. I don't know. I try not to read the radiology reads on my post. Yeah. I just look at it myself.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know.
You don't have Epic. So for me, they go to my inbox.
And I still have an inbox. I still have an inbox.
Do the reads go to your inbox?
Some of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Mine always go to my inbox. So I always have to see them when I click that I've seen them. And I browse to the impression. I'm like, man, this radiologist, man, they're not helping me out at all. So
yeah, you can always tell who's a good radiologist or not by who helps you out with their post-op reads.
Yeah. Sometimes they're like, and it's funny, you really see how little understanding some of them have about orthopedics. Like, I'll put a lag screw and a neutralization plate or like two lag screws, and the read will be like, there are two screws that have missed the plate or something that were erroneously placed outside the plate. I'm like, guys, come on. And then the funniest one, they put stuff like, oh, advised clinical correlation. I'm like, dude, of course, I'm seeing the patient in clinic. So I'm obviously seeing them. So
yeah, you'll have that stuff where if the Synthes syndesmotic thing, basically, like there's a screw stuck in the tibia. So they'll always read it as broken screw in the tibia. And it's like, what do you guys, come on. Like, if you don't know, call and ask so that you don't put this stuff. And then a lawyer picks it up and reads it. And it's like, why'd you leave a broken screw in the tibia?
And just support the patients now have access.
Right. The patients have access to all this stuff too.
So they come in and ask about it.
But yeah. This jerk off surgeon left a broken screw in my tibia.
Yeah. So it's kind of annoying.
Chris Carter, MD, thank you for the good dude tweet.
Good dude of the week.
All right, Brendan, sorry, I didn't mean to put you in a compromising position there. So the last thing we ask every guest that comes on, what's your favorite bone?
Favorite bone?
Yeah.
Probably femur, because I'm also strong and unbreakable.
Ooh. You had that one ready.
But
that's funny. Yeah, it was like an interview answer, so wow. Yeah, I was ready.
No, I like it. But what if it breaks? What if the femur breaks?
You know, that's what you guys are for, right?
Cool. All right, man. Thanks for coming on and appreciate
it. Thanks for coming on, Brendan. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Good. Thanks, man. Bye.
Take care.
And that'll do it for this week. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. If you do like the episode and you want to hear any of our other previous videos, go to our website, orthotalkpod.com. If you want to catch the video for any of these episodes, you could do so at our YouTube channel. Just YouTube Orthotalk Podcast, and all our videos will come up. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do so at our Twitter, at OrthotalkPod, or at our Gmail, theorthopodcast@gmail.com. And if you guys really like what we're doing, please leave us a 5-star review on whatever podcasting platform or video platform you are listening to. It really does help us out. And we'll have more for you next week. Thank you all for the opportunity.